Hey everyone, I'm Kelsey Snow, and this is Sorry I'm Sad, a podcast about grief, loss, and the importance of hope. In this space, we've explored lots of different sadnesses: mental health, suicide, cancer, illness, sexual abuse, accidents, and disabilities. In my own life, I spend a lot of time thinking about the drawn-out nature of my family's sad story. Today's story is different. This story is about tragedy that suddenness will take your breath away, about one person's experience of the worst-case scenarios we imagine actually playing out. It's about a day that starts out with the summer sun shining and ends with your world forever changed. And it's about how we share our sad stories with others. A friendly reminder that if you value this podcast and these conversations and want to support my work, you can go to www.patreon.com/KelseySnow, that's KelseSnow, to become a member. For the monthly cost of one latte, you can help keep this work going, help keep it ad-free, help it grow, and get access to the Sorry I'm Sad Patreon community. The other ways to show your support, of course, are to keep listening, to leave us a rating and a review, and to share this show with others. Any and all of those things are deeply appreciated. Nikki Elson is an assistant drama professor at the University of Lethbridge, where she lives with her husband, Kelly, and young daughter, Ruby. She's a wife, a mom, a friend, and a daughter. And while I could say a lot more about our conversation, this is Nikki's story, and I'll let her tell it. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Nikki. I really appreciate it. It has been quite a whirlwind trying to actually do this. I said to Andrea, who is our common friend who kind of linked us up, that I think I've never felt more unprofessional than I have with Nikki. I have had to reschedule. I think the first time, was the first time my husband was in the hospital.
Was it like in November?
Yeah. And then the second time my daughter had been sick and I didn't feel well. And then Wednesday we were supposed to do it. And then my husband had to have a last minute doctor's appointment for some other things. So I was like, oh, this is not going well for me.
But it was chaotic for everybody right now. So yeah, honestly, every time that you're like, can we postpone? I was like, oh, good. Now I can do the other thing.
Oh, okay. Good.
Not a fun thing. Not a thing I'm looking forward to, but just, you know, like emails and all those things. Right.
Yeah. So, no, there's so many.
This is a good day. This is a
okay.
Good day.
Good. Sure. Good. Kids are in school, like we said before, yeah. Started recording for this week anyway. That's why I was like, I better do it this week because next week they're liable to be. They're liable to be home. Who knows? So like I briefly said, Andrea first told me about you when we were on a walk one day. So Andrea is, it's her song in my intro and outro to podcast. Yep. And so Andrea, my singing friend, is the one who introduced me to Nikki. And we were talking about the way that we interact with people, about kind of our sad stories. And she was mentioning, she mentioned your name to me because we were talking about the fact that early on in, my husband's diagnosis, I wrote an email and that was how I realized that I needed to share was over an email because I didn't want to be a part of other people's grieving process. I didn't kind of want to see their reaction to that, like initial hearing that Chris had this disease, because while it's not saying Chris is dead, it is saying Chris is dying. And that is a hard thing for people in the moment, I think, to know how to react to. Mm-hmm. And I had just learned after telling a couple people in person that I didn't want to be a part of their reaction to it. So we were talking about that and she brought up the fact that when you lost your mom, you did a similar thing. Mm-hmm. So that's just kind of how we ended up here. And I wondered, what year did you lose your mom?
It was in 2005. So about 16 and a half years ago now. Okay.
Yeah. And you were 30?
I was 29 or 30 then, I think. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, and I should segue with the Andrea thing with her song. Did she ever mention that we used to be in a band together?
I don't know if she did. We talked about theater, but I don't know if she mentioned the band.
Yeah, we were in a band. We had several names, all of them terrible, but I just wanted to add that in there. So
I love it. I'll have to see if she has any of that music. I know that many of my podcast listeners now listen to Andrea's music on Spotify. My mom included.
Amazing. That's awesome.
Yeah. They love
it. Yeah. It was 2005 and I was, I think I was 30. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, before we kind of go through that day, that you lost your mom, I just wondered if you could tell me a little bit about her.
Yeah. So Elizabeth Howell Reese was her name. It's a very unusual middle name. It's a tradition in Wales where she's from that you sometimes get given your mother's maiden name as your middle name. So okay. Yeah, her middle name is Howell. She's unusual. And she grew up in South Wales in a small community. Her father was an Anglican minister. She grew up playing a organ in the church. She ended up becoming a nurse, met my father, he was working in Wales for a little bit. He's from England. And they moved to California. It was actually one of the first places that they moved to. Okay. So a small town Wales girl going to California, my brother was actually, I have an older brother named Tim who lives out in Halifax. He's a musician out there. And he was born in England just before they left. I was born in California. We lived there for 2 years. I have zero memories of a beautiful place like that. And we moved directly from there to Fort McMurray.
Oh,
I remember my mom telling a story of like her car breaking down in the winter and she's walking with me in her arms and she's crying because she thinks she's going to die because it's so cold out and all the tears are like freezing on our faces. And it was fine. Like someone picked her up like a minute later kind of thing. Right. But yeah, you know, like if you go from California to Fort Mac, it's a bit of a culture shock. I think it's fair to say, but yeah, she worked, in nursing primarily before she had kids. And then we were lucky. We had her as a stay-at-home mom for a lot of that time. And then as we got older, she ended up working in doctor's offices and things like that. And one of the things that really stood out for me was she worked in, like seniors facilities, as a nurse. And I remember her saying that she would see sometimes if people had worked there for too long, they would start to desensitize. Mm-hmm. And because you can't feel it for that long, you can't take it home all the time. Right. And she would see other nurses sometimes for stopping talking to the people that lived there and like, just like doing the job. And it was became very functional and always stuck with me. She said, I want to just be here for as long as I can be like really present and connected. And I think she would stay for like 5 years or something. And then was like, okay, I can't do that anymore because I don't want to become desensitized. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so for me, my mom was like the epitome of a caregiver. Mm-hmm. So with us, with her work, with our pets, like we grew up with dogs and like, you know, when the dogs would get old, it would be my mom that would be taking care of them all the time. So there was a real nurturing quality about her that I think everybody really loved about her. And then, yeah, as she went into retirement, she, you know, was, you know, the classic thing of like getting it back into the baking and garden gnomes everywhere in the backyard and camping all the time. And, you know, her group of ladies that went golfing together, all that kind of stuff. Mm. It was actually quite sad. When she was going through menopause, she was on some medication and it wasn't working very well. So they gave her another type of medication to try with it. And it was experimental. And the two drugs in combination actually gave her breast cancer.
Oh.
And she went through the whole thing of getting the mastectomy, lost her hair, all that kind of stuff. And she had just gotten her kind of 1 year breast cancer survivor button or whatever you get when she passed away.
Oh man.
Yeah. But so a real fighter, a person who was full of empathy, and very silly and very sweet. So that was
you sent me a few things that you have written, including your email that you sent to your friends, but you sent me, I think it was the eulogy maybe that you delivered at your mom's funeral or something that you wrote that sounded kind of like a eulogy. And you wrote in there was something that I loved that anytime you and your brother were home, it was like such a celebration for her. She would be like trying to slip champagne into your orange juice and things like
every
that.
Every morning. She would always say, would you like something in it? Like, Mom, no, I don't want any alcohol right now. I just wanted to have a little party all the time. So Yeah.
Life was really a celebration for her.
Yeah. And it's been really nice. Like when you asked me to pull those things up that like, I forgot about some of those things, right? Those little quirks about somebody that you love so much, but like, it's been 16 and a half years. And I actually started crying a little bit because I was like, I forgot about those things, because so often when somebody all death is sad, but when it's a tragedy, like an accident like this, you spend a lot of time talking about that and you don't spend as much time talking about all these wonderful memories that you have. Right. Mm-hmm. So kind of, it was actually a really welcome to look back at those letters and those emails and the poem and all that kind of stuff. And looking back at old pictures and being like, oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. And there's something too, that I always find frustrating, is now I'm like, oh, in this time period, I would have had voice recordings of her. Right. I would have had videos. I would have had all these things, and I don't have anything. Like I have a, I don't want it to make it sound like my mom liked drinking that much, because she really didn't. But I have one of the few things I have from her is a gin and tonic glass.
Oh.
It's like an old, like from the 1960s, beautiful glass. And it's my water glass that I have now, but I'm like, oh, right. That's like, you know, you just kind of want to hold on to these things that they touched all the time. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, so. Totally. Yeah. And I think that's such an interesting point about like forgetting those little nuances about a person, because realistically speaking, like you have lived a lot of life since your mom died, and a lot of the like really huge parts of your life, you've had to live without her, right? Like you got married, you had a child, and all of those things take up space in your head, and you can forget the things that came before them. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, then that's the thing that I think makes me the saddest, is that she didn't get to go to the wedding. She didn't get to meet Ruby.
Yeah.
She would have been an amazing grandma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm sure that my husband has lost both his parents, and his mom died when my son, who's 10, was 6 months old. And we have a few photos of her holding him when he was an infant, like when he was at his baptism. She was the same, and she would have been like such a player, you know. Mm-hmm. It would have been like, my son plays hockey, and she would have been outside playing hockey with him. Then she would have come inside and brush doll hair for 6 hours. Right. And you know, those things and sort of just the injustice of them, of your mom missing that and of your kids missing that is hard to swallow.
Well, it's strange because, you know, I've never done a podcast before, but my kid has. Yeah. She's 7, and there's when she was 6, we have some friends in Calgary that do, I've forgotten what it's called now, but it's basically they interview people from very different age ranges to find out what they have in common with them. So they'll interview people that are in their 90s, and they'll interview 5-year-olds and things like this. So this woman, Karen Johnson Diamond, who's part of that, she asked Ruby to be a part of this podcast where they would just find out, you know, what she likes. And, you know, and like, he was really into Ozzy Osbourne as a 6-year-old, which is really weird. But it's because of Trolls, the movie Trolls, right? Because they have all that music in there, right? But just right in the middle of it, she just started talking about my mom, and she's like quite like fascinated by the fact that there's somebody that was important in my life who has died and that she never got to meet. And she tells me all the time, "Mommy, I wished on the North Star again that your mommy could come back," kind of thing. Right. Yeah. And it's heartbreaking, but it was this real fascination there. And so she's just brought it up in the middle of this podcast, and we're all like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, right. So,
man, yeah, it's crazy the depth of their thought process. We often sell them short on that end, I think.
Oh yeah.
These little ones, and they're thinking things all the time that I don't even know if we want to know, because it's heartbreaking. It's so deep, and the things that are on their minds. And I think it's this awakening too for your daughter that I think for a lot of kids doesn't come until they're a lot older, realizing that their parents had this whole other life before they were there.
Yeah.
And it kind of just, you know, sped that up in her, knowing that like, oh, my mom's mom is gone. And so she had this whole life that I can never.
Yeah.
Touch,
yeah.
She right?
feels a little indignant that she hasn't gotten to meet her. And I mean, I'm the type of parent that like, if they ask a question, I'll answer it kind of thing. Like I won't necessarily offer things that they haven't been asking,
but
you know, she was asking about like burial, and I was like, well, cremation is, you know, what we did. And then she's all like, Mom, when you and Dad died, I'll burn you. And I was just like, oh, that's
nice. Thank you. That's my dream. This is a great conversation. Good night, sweetheart. Yeah. You want some more carrots with your dinner? Like,
yeah, I know.
Right.
Oh, man.
Well, you know, I think a lot about the different types of tragedy. And, you know, Chris's mom died very suddenly. She actually died of suicide. And Chris's dad died of ALS. He's had both of these kinds of losses, these sudden ones that you didn't get a chance to sort of try to tie up your loose ends.
Yeah.
And then one that's different. And your story is much more abrupt. And I wondered, if you don't mind, if it's not too hard, if you can just really walk us through that day, because I can picture it in my head as a Calgarian, a beautiful, yes, sunny summer day.
Yep.
Yeah. What month was it?
It was August the 5th, I believe it was. So I've been living in London, England at the mm-hmm. time, and was homesick and was looking for, so because I'd been there for about 5 years, and I was looking for reasons to, like, you know, come back and visit and stuff. And I my background is in theater. So there's fringe festivals, like theater fringe festivals that happen across the country and other countries. And so we applied for a bunch of the fringe fests here. And so we're in the middle of doing that tour. And then we came back to Calgary. So I was there with my friend Moira, who had come from England. Okay. With me as part of the show. And we decided that we would go down the Bow River. Yeah. And so my dad and Moira were in one dinghy, and my mom and I were both in tire tubes, and we were floating down the river. Yeah. So you park a car at one side, you have another.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you get in? For people who aren't from Calgary who are listening, the Bow River winds through Calgary, and a very popular summertime activity is to float mm-hmm. or raft, or, you know, do the paddleboard or whatever down the Bow River. Lots of families, you know, lots of people. It's not a fast, super fast moving river. And it's in general a very safe activity. So we usually do it once a year. We put in up in Bowness Park, and then we get out at the curling club, right?
Yeah. And I think we were doing something similar. And it was when we were going past Shouldice Park. I don't know why we wanted to go to the shore, if it felt like it was getting fast then, or we just wanted a break. So we all had life jackets on. But our mistake was that we actually had taken ropes, and we had tied the ropes between the dinghy and the tire tube so that we wouldn't float too far apart from each other. And when we started coming towards the shore, it's a weird thing when you're in the middle of the river, you don't really get a sense of how fast it is in that spot. But as we were coming, of course, there's the Shouldice Bridge, which has got like the big pillars going down into the river. And we were trying to like steer ourselves towards the shore, and the dinghy went to one side of the pillar, and the tire tubes went to the other side. And I just got thrown off and went down the river immediately. And my dad and Moira were still in the dinghy, and they kind of saw what had happened. And my mom, somehow the rope had got caught around her and around her neck and like pushed her down. So it was only about 3 feet of water. Like if it wasn't so fast moving, you could stand in there, no problem. So even though she had a life jacket on, she was getting pushed under from the rope getting tied on her and the force of the water. So my dad and Moira both tried to get to her, and the second they would reach out, they got swept down the river as well. And then at that point, I kind of got back up onto the shore and had run back over. And it's that moment that I think we've all had in our life when something, you think something really terrible is going to happen, but you're like talking yourself down. You're like, no, it's
going to can't be that bad.
Mm-hmm. It was okay. Like we'll figure it out kind of thing. Right. And so then other people started on the shore that were not part of our group saw, and were starting to run in to try to help. And every person started getting swept down the river. And then this one man, a stranger, he went upstream and he ran out and then got swept back down and managed to get to her. And her head is submerged this entire time.
The rope was around her neck?
Well, I don't know if it was around her neck or around the collar of, like, I don't think she got strangled.
Just pushed her down
somehow, right? And so he eventually got there, and then somebody else, I believe, at the top ran up to the top of the bridge and threw a knife down. And then he managed to cut the rope to free her. But it was so much effort for him on that part that, like, he was nearly going to drown at this point, right? So he couldn't carry her. And I don't really remember, but I do sort of remember that there was people around me and they were trying to hold me back. But then I ran. And I always remember this, that I had bare feet and I ran on all the rocks in through the river, and my feet did not hurt at all. Like, it was light. It was so light. And I ran in there and I managed to get to her and swim back with her. And I remember as soon as I flipped her over, you could see her eyes already had that gray white film. And I just remember going, like, oh my God, like it happened so fast, right? Like, I don't know how long she was in there. It could have been 2 minutes. It could have been 15 minutes. I don't know. But yeah, I pulled her out, and then there was people around, and somebody there, I think, must have known CPR and was trying to do something. And then the paramedics were there. Strangely, a friend of mine, her husband was a paramedic, and he was there, and we didn't find that out until years later, kind of thing. Right. But yeah, I mean, she died in the water before anybody had gotten to her. Right. And then, I remember very distinctly that the press had been called and they were coming up and putting, like, microphones in our faces. And I do remember yelling at them. I don't remember exactly what I said, except that I was not happy that they were there, kind of thing.
Of course.
Yeah. And then the next thing, we're sitting in the back of an ambulance, but my mom's not there. It's me and my dad sitting in the back of the ambulance. And I remember I was hyperventilating for like an hour or something. Like, I just couldn't catch my breath. And then the next thing I remember is, we had to go get the car, and a police officer drove me to get the car, and she was supposed to drive the car back. And I think it was like her first day or something. Oh. A new police officer, but she didn't know how to drive a standard. So I remember I was like, it's okay, I'll drive, kind of thing, right? And then the first night I slept in my dad's bed. It's the only time I've done that as an adult, but the two of us slept in a bed together. And then I was like, I can't leave him, right? Like, he's like, you know, we'll be watching TV dinners or eating TV dinners at 3 o'clock at night, watching British football games and by himself. And I was like, bah. So yeah, I went back to England, got all my stuff and moved back in with my dad. And I lived with him for like 2 years and then was like, oh shit, now I can never leave. What am I going to do? Right. Yeah. And then he, started seeing some of his friends more. It's an interesting thing with that generation, because also my dad was 13 years older than my mom as well. Okay. So he was already older. But you don't go to social events by yourself very easily, right? You need to have a partner. And so I became this weird partner. Like, I would go to the engineering societies and the Welsh society, and we started taking cooking classes together and all this stuff. But he eventually started doing other things, and he would go to this timeshare place with his buddy Steve Ma. And I remember going, oh, are you going again with Steve? And he said, oh, no, I'm going with Sheila. And I was like, Sheila? And it was a friend from our entire childhood. Her husband died, like, I think the day before my mom died or something like that. They're a day apart in age. They're both so ridiculously British. They watch documentaries on the making of tea. Like, it's like, and yeah. And so then he ended up, you know, years later, finding Sheila and marrying, and I was able to feel good about going on with my life. But I think one of the things that I wish I had been able to do is find out the name of the man who tried to save my mom. Because I remember something in the newspapers where he'd received a medal for it. And I didn't save that newspaper, and I have no idea what his name is. So if anybody's hearing this and knows that in 2005 in August, if you knew somebody who tried to save a woman's life, that was my mom.
Yeah.
And I would love to say thank you.
Wow. Well, we will see if we can get that to, I'm sure we can carry that once this goes. We'll see if we can find him at Shoal Dice.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. 2005. Okay. We'll figure that out. So I think that one of the hardest things for me, and I'm only speaking from my experience here. And obviously when my husband was diagnosed, I still had him. So it's not the same thing as what you went through, but I remember just like the fact that I had to carry on with the parts of life that had to get done. Like you're saying, go get the car. I remember for me, my car tires were low on air and I had to fill them up. And I remember doing it thinking like, what the fuck? Yeah. How am I supposed to fill up my car tires with air? Like how that for me was one of the hardest parts after he was diagnosed, is just the putting one foot in front of the other for the sake of regular life.
And how many people ask you how you're doing? You don't realize that when you're not going through grief, but everyone's like, hey, how you doing today? And you're like,
oh yeah. And I just, and I have a real problem with not answering questions like that authentically. Yes. And so it always just be like, I felt like I was lying all the time. And then that made me have this weird amount of guilt. So I've had to like come up with it. I usually just say, oh, I'm hanging in there. That's what I say now.
Right. Yeah. You find something that's like neutral, but not dishonest.
Yeah. I had to, because I had, I definitely had a weird thing about that. And for me, which is totally different than you, like we didn't tell people right away. And so I also had this like feeling of holding something back from people, which again is a hard thing for me to do. So that was a different thing for me, but I wonder what that was like for you, the having to do the everyday parts of life after having experienced like probably the most traumatic thing anybody could ever go through.
Yeah. The weird thing with grief, and whether it's grief from like losing somebody to death or like heartbreak or whatever it might be kind of thing. It's that moment in the morning when you wake up where you've forgotten. Mm-hmm. And then that like ton of bricks kind of feeling that hits you when you're like, oh my God, this is happening right now. I was in the middle of this fringe tour, and obviously all the other artists I was working with was like, okay, we're canceling, obviously. And I was like, no, I want to go and keep doing it. And I don't know if it's some weird, like feeling like I had to, like, I felt guilty to like not do it. And I certainly wasn't getting any of that pressure from the people I was working with at all, but I think I went to do the Edmonton Fringe like a couple weeks after it. And I remember like performing on stage and like standing on a box and sort of blacking out and sort of losing my balance and stuff. And just, you know, going like, what am I doing? And I remember being at a bar after a show one night, and I think it couldn't have been Mother's Day. It might've been my mom's birthday, cause she was around that time. But like, just like people, I don't know, there was just like this celebratory feeling that was happening there, and you're just kind of standing in the middle of it like, why am I here, right? And I think I was only at the Fringe for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, and then I was back with my dad again, right? But so there was that weird sense of obligation that only I put on myself, that nobody else did. And then there was the getting things organized for the funeral, like right immediately afterwards. Like I ended up, I was asked to call everybody in the UK, in England and Wales, right? Mm-hmm. So these are people that are like very, very close to my mom and already had missed her so much because she'd moved to another country and they knew her growing up and all this. And it was having to repeat the same conversation and to console each individual as they went through their initial reaction to this news. Like, I think I spent an entire day calling person after person. And just like, by the end of the day, I was like, which is probably why I sent the email.
That's out. What I was just thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. To all of my friends and the people in Canada, right? That I think I was just like, I can't keep doing this. Like, it's too much. Right. And then, you know, weird things like, oh, we need to go pick an outfit out for her. Cause I kind of hated it, but, it was open casket, which I don't like, but anyway, yeah. So we had to pick an outfit out, and like, how do you pick out what your mom's supposed to wear in a coffin? Like,
I don't know.
Right.
No.
So stuff like that was weird. And the other thing that was really weird, again, I have no idea why we did this. And I've talked to people since then, and I don't know anybody who's done this, but you can view the cremation, which is just nuts, right?
Yeah.
So my dad and my brother and I were sitting in this crematorium watching like the doors open to the fiery hells, and you watch the coffin go through. My dad just is weeping, and I'm like, why are we here? Like, this is just so messed up, right?
Oh God. Like, you hadn't been through enough trauma.
Yeah. And then, oh, and I should mention my brother as well, because my brother was in Halifax at the time, and he was actually having a party the night that my mom had died. And my dad had called once, and because he had some people over, he's like, oh, I'll call him back later, and kind of put his phone away. And then, like, you know, an hour later or whatever, he checked his phone and there's like 10 missed calls from my dad. And he just kind of went to the front step and sat down and was like, I think he knew
something.
He didn't know what the news was, but he knew that something really bad had happened for there to be that many calls there. Right. And I think one of the things that was really hard for him was that he wasn't there, and I'm his little sister too, right? So this feeling of wanting to kind of be able to look out for his little sister, I think that was really hard that he wasn't there. And I was humor with grief is always a an interesting thing. I remember sitting in the funeral home with my brother once he got there, and we started making a joke about my mom not approving of like the jackets that we were wearing or something like that. You're not going to wear that. And we did like a little imitation of her, and we like burst out laughing, and it immediately shift into sobbing, right? That like, we felt bad that we just kind of like made a joke about our mom who had just died kind of thing. Right. Even though it was through fondness. Right.
Yeah. So, I think it's one or the other so often with grief. Like, well, we can laugh about this because it's so horribly sad, or we could cry about it because it's so horribly sad. And sometimes one feels better than the other.
Yes. Right. And just how quickly you might switch from one state of being to the other. One thing that I was happy though, is I got to write my mom a poem, and I got to read it at the service and things like that. And that felt cathartic. That felt nice to be able to do that. And then after that, it was strange, but my friends that I was working with in theater, a whole bunch of us had gone through loss. One of my dearest friends, her partner unexpectedly died of a heart condition that he'd developed as a child that had kind of been dormant, and he just dropped one day on the street. And this was the person that I think she'd hoped to spend her life with. And then another friend, her father was going through dementia and was getting put into a home. We had another friend whose brother had taken his life. It had all happened within like 3 or 4 months that we'd all experienced this loss. And so we were like, let's make a comedy about death. Mm-hmm. So we created a show called Death a Comedy, which was like these two clowns that traveled through space and time, experiencing funeral rituals from around the world, from different cultures, things like that. And we thought that would be a great idea, but it was actually really, I think that we had fun doing it, but it was also like, it's hard because you don't want to confuse theater with therapy. They're two different things, right? And sometimes things are too fresh, right? So I don't know. I mean, I'm still glad that we did it, but it was also like, these are weird choices we're making right now.
Yeah. Well, again, you just have to do whatever feels best in that moment in those situations, because grief hits in such weird ways at different times, and you never know, right? You never know how it's going to come out. I did want to talk about your email, and I read my email today for the first time. And since I was sending it around, which was this summer will be 3 years, I guess, already. And I know that, just like you're saying, the telling of people was so hard, and what you said about you ended up consoling them.
Yeah.
And I haven't really felt angry at the way that people react to me. Like I generally give people a good amount of grace because I don't really even know how to still interact with other people's grief. I only understand sort of my own, right? And so yeah. I'm generally not like that person who's like, oh, don't, you said this wrong. You said this wrong. My feeling about grief is like, nobody talks about it enough and it's not on the table enough. And when we spend a lot of time telling people that's the wrong thing to say, that's the wrong thing to say, and that's the wrong thing to say, they just don't say anything, which I find is the worst thing to say is nothing at all. And so I generally don't get worked up. I did find myself feeling angry only when I told people if I felt like their reaction was strange or if I felt like their reaction just wasn't exactly what I wanted it to be, which is totally unfair because I don't even know what I wanted their reaction to be.
Right.
I just knew if it didn't feel right or if it did feel right. And then I just didn't want to. I mean, it's one thing for you to send me an email and tell me what happened, but when you're going to say it again out loud, right? Like it becomes so emotional for the teller. So for me, it was self-preservation. Absolutely. At the same time, I've wondered if sending that email has at times kept people from asking me questions because it felt kind of like I shut a door.
Yes.
And I wondered if you could speak to your experience with that after you sent your friends the email.
Well, it's funny because I haven't read the email in like a really long time, like years and years. And I reread it for this podcast when you asked me to send it to you. And, you know, I described what had happened. And then there was a sentence at the end that says, and then I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm like, that's not true. You know, like it might've been true in the moment. Right. But like, it's not that I want to talk about that day necessarily, but I want to talk about my mom. Yes. And I feel like our society, there's such a taboo around grief. And like, we're very nervous around it. We don't know how to, you know, and like when I see like, you know, people from different cultures where they have like keeners, there are people that are actually wailing and being part of that world, whether they're people that are close to the person who's departed or not, like this, how normal it is to do that in those cultures. Right. And I still remember like at the funeral, like having moments of like, keep it together, don't cry. And I was like, okay, if there's ever a moment that you should not have to keep it together, it's now.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure this is an okay time to lose it a little bit. Right. Yeah. But like, it's so ingrained. And yeah. So, I mean, I think part of it is like, you're not always in a place that is intimate and safe and you have the time to talk about it. Cause if you meet a friend at a grocery store or, you know, like there's other friends around or whatever, and like, by the way, want to talk about this? It's just like, it's hard to talk about it lightly, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course. Yes.
So it's like those moments where you've gone out for a drink with a friend or whatever, right? Like they could come up there, but I don't know. It's that thing of not wanting to feel like you're monopolizing conversations and things.
And yeah. And you feel like you're adding, for me, the best friendships I have are the people who I can really just say, this is happening. And I don't feel like I'm adding weight to them. Like, it's not like a pity. Oh, now I have to feel bad for Kelsey kind of a thing. I just want to be able to say it. Right.
Yeah.
I also have come to this place where you mentioned people asking, how are you? How, you know, I get a lot. How are you? How's Chris? And there's a different like way that people ask that question when they're not just doing it. Like you say it to the mailman, like, hey, how are you? Right.
Yeah.
And I always say like, think about who you're asking that question for. Like, are you asking it for them? Mm-hmm. Or are you asking that question because you're curious? And for you, really, you know, I'm sure people were very curious to hear about what happened because it was so traumatic and such a tragedy that happened with your mom. But in writing that email, you're saying, this is what happened. I don't want to talk about that anymore. Like, it was horrible. Yeah. And I don't need to satisfy your curiosity about the worst day of my life.
Yeah.
Right. That's really what it comes down to. And so I always say, I'd rather you just say, I'm thinking of you. And then if I want to keep going, I can, but otherwise they don't even know, right? People don't know in those days, especially weeks, months after your mom died, when they say, how are you? They don't even know if they're unearthing inside you.
No.
Right.
No. And you don't want you don't want somebody's end to be what defines them.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. So like with your husband, I'm sure you want to talk about things other than his illness. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about things other than my mom drowning. Right. Like, yes. And so I think where I feel envious is when I have friends who have one or both of their parents and they're able to talk about like what they did last weekend kind of thing. Like just the mundane things of like, oh, my mom did this or blah, blah, blah. Or she's driving me crazy or whatever kind of thing. Right. That I'm like, I can't do that. So how do I find a way to talk about her personality, the fun stories and stuff that is obviously past tense, that's somehow relevant, right? Because it doesn't feel relevant.
You just feel like you're weirdly inserting a story about your dead mom into a conversation and people are like, what's wrong with Nikki?
Like a little off topic, but all right. All right.
Like, so. Oh, my mom watched my kid yesterday. And you're like, I remember when I was a young child and my mom did. Right. It's like hard to find those moments. I will say that in my walk with Andrea, where she first mentioned you to me, she talked a lot about how much she loved your mom and how great your mom was and how she really enjoys talking about your mom with you now.
And my parents, like my dad too, love Andrea.
Well, Andrea is very easy to love. Yeah.
So that's nice for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
And it is like I have friends from this pretty much from my university days primarily who had come over to visit my parents when I would go visit them and stuff. And so they knew them.
Yeah.
Whereas most of the people that I am in contact with now in person, as much as in person you can during a pandemic, but like they never met my mom. They don't really know my dad. Like, I mean, my husband never met my mom, right? Yeah. Like she died before I met him. Right. Mm-hmm. So there is this group of people like Andrea and other folks where I'm like, oh yeah, you guys knew her.
Yeah.
And so there's something really fun about getting to like, and like there's pictures of like my parents with those friends and stuff too. So when I get to see those friends, I feel like there's an understanding there of who is missing and what that means. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. That other folks, as empathetic as they can be, can only imagine.
Yeah. Right?
So
I think the other thing that's interesting about writing an email is that when Andrea told me about it, it was very clear that like that really stuck with her and it made an impact on her. And she remembers still that email. And I think it would still influence the way that she interacts with you. Whereas when you're talking about the email and you went back and read it, you didn't even really remember what you said in it. Right. And so I think that that's such an interesting thing, what your friends take from that message and the lasting effect of it versus you saying in that moment, you had just told 50 people in the UK how your mom died. And you were like, I don't want to talk about this anymore. And you sent it in that moment and kind of maybe unwittingly putting an end to this conversation or something.
Yeah.
It was just an interesting, I think, dynamic, the way that other people interact with our grief versus how we think that we are presenting it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny, in the past couple of years, there's actually been a couple opportunities to talk about it. And it's weird that you're like 16 years later. Oh, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you don't find those opportunities, and it'll be in like various like things with working in theater and stuff like that, where, you know, there's, you know, I was working on the show with a local company called Theater Outre, where they would have you come up on stage and people would ask you questions. And so it wasn't really like theater in the traditional sense. It certainly wasn't fictional, but people would ask you questions and different things would come out, and like the topic of grief and loss came up. And so I shared a little bit about it at this theater company in front of an intimate audience. And I was like, whoa, that's the first time I think I've done that. And that was like, I don't know, 3 years ago. So I went for like a good decade without really, and then suddenly going, oh. And then you approach me a couple of years later and I'm like, oh, this is nice. And I have a colleague who's doing, has death as a theme for like a lot of her creative research and stuff that she does. Like we've talked about it a little bit. So it's interesting how it pops up. And like the whole thing with grief is like, there are times, long periods of times where it's like totally fine. And then there's these weird like triggers, like my mom loves, the Beatles, right? And Yesterday is one of her favorite songs. Every time that fucker of a song comes on, I'm like, ah, right? So there's those kinds of things. And like, I was watching, I can't do a spoiler, but I was watching the Spider-Man movie, but there was something that happened in there. And the person that it happened to just looked like my mom when my mom was dying. Oh. And I was just in the theater and it's 16 unit and I'm just like got my little face mask on and I'm just, and my kid is beside me and I'm like, keep it together. Yeah. Kind of thing, just like weeping. And I was like, from Spider-Man? Yeah. Really? Okay.
Right. Oh man. Thought it would have been something deeper than Spider-Man.
Right? Right. But it's, these triggers kind of like surprise you. They come out of nowhere. Right. But,
What was that like that first time then that you stood on that stage and kind of went through it for the first time? What did that feel like afterward?
Well, it was just a one-time thing. So it's not like you had repeated or anything.
Right, yeah.
Like that, but so vulnerable, right? Mm. And again, this feeling of like, I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable, right? So you gloss over things. Like I find it easy to talk to you because I know you're going through it. Mm-hmm. And it's intimate. I know other people will hear this eventually, but it doesn't feel like it right now.
Yeah.
So this feels like a lot easier to just be like, okay, I can actually say some details. Yeah. I'm not worried about freaking people out because people can always just press pause, whatever they want. Right. But in that, I think I was still like, try to keep it light. Well, even now I'm like making jokes, right? You can't help it. But I think even more so when I was doing that. And I think I spoke about it for like a very short period of time because I don't want to.
Yeah, it's that feeling of, is this too much? Is this too much?
Right.
Too much?
Yeah. Yeah. So you're always kind of censoring yourself, I think, right? Yeah. I mean, I think the only person I don't censor myself about it is with my husband, who's just awesome, right? And and is really great at just letting me feel how I want to feel and be there. And,
I think it's just so interesting the length of time that you went and that it kind of took you by surprise. Like you didn't like plan on talking about it after a decade. It just kind of happened. Right. That's kind of really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, all death is traumatic, obviously, but the way that your mom died was especially so. And I wonder about that added element for your grief and what the trauma of the way that your mom died, how that impacted the way that you processed your grief.
I mean, I think the thing that is hard to shake is people always talk about how drowning is like one of the worst ways to die.
Yeah.
And obviously I don't know what that feels like. Right. But like, you know, you hope for everyone that you love that they pass away in their sleep, like Betty White, you know, at night.
Right. Exactly. Right?
And so even if you do pass away earlier, it's the suffering, and whether it's like with your husband, where it's long, or whether it's with my mom, where it's this intense moment and I don't know how long it lasted and how long the awareness was there, but that it would have been just horrific for her. Right. That's hard to shake. And I think, I'm a bit morbid now. Like I think everybody kind of has these like awful daydreams of terrible things happening to people that they love. But I think there's a part of me that's like, but I know it actually can happen. Right. And so like, especially like with my kid, like, you know, you go down the rabbit hole of terrible daydreams of things that can happen to them. And so those kinds of things can sometimes be a little bit hard to shake off. Mm-hmm. But it also, you know, you got to find the silver lining and you go, okay, you know, live in the now, man, like all that kind of stuff, right? Like appreciating, and it's so easy not to appreciate every moment to get slogged down, especially over the past 2 years and stuff like that for everybody, right? But just this kind of like truly appreciate how short life can be, right? Yeah. And this is from somebody who passed away. She was 58, so she still had, you know, a lot of life lived, right?
Yeah.
you know, compared to, you know, somebody who's lost someone when they were very young is mm-hmm. you know, I think the ultimate tragedy for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, so not silver lining, dusty, gross copper lining.
Yeah.
Is that you have a morbid sense of tragedy around you, and silver lining is to appreciate what's going on and to make plans that matter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Definitely. I think a lot about out of order death. And I think that for you, it was an especially like hard, it's always hard when you lose a parent, but like you were, when you lose anybody, but when, you know, you weren't like a small child, you weren't necessarily a super young adult. You were a young adult, but you weren't in your 20s. You were in your late 20s. I have two really good friends who are sisters, and they lost their parents within years of each other from cancer. And they were in their 20s, like late 20s, early 30s, mid 20s, in that range. And what a weird time that is in your life to lose somebody, because you're an adult, but it's still not, you're not supposed to lose your parents when you're 30, right? Like, and I just wondered what that was like for you going through that at that time. I know that it was weird sometimes for my friends, like their friends didn't know how to interact with them. You know, they were still young enough that people didn't really understand how to interact with grief. Not that anybody ever does, but yeah, it's just kind of that, it's a strange sort of window, right?
Yeah, I know. I think there's some weird part of me that wishes I was 29 instead of 30, because then people will go, oh yeah, you're in your 20s. That must be hard. But you go, oh, you're in your 30s. It's like, but just, I was like for a couple months. Right? Yeah. It's to lose your mom that young, pre-marriage, pre-kid, if you choose to do either of those things kind of thing, is I think the thing that I have a harder time kind of reconciling for sure.
And you really, you know, you already mentioned this, but you completely changed the course of your life, as it would with any loss like this changed, but you like literally moved over an ocean and changed the trajectory of what was going to happen to you potentially, right? To be there for your dad. And I just wonder if you can talk about kind of what that was like for you to kind of put your life on hold to care for your dad as he was grieving.
It's an interesting thing because like I said, I'd lived in England for 5 years and I was working, you know, freelance, trying to work in theater. And also like I worked at the Wax Museum of Horror there, the London Dungeon, going, would you like to be tortured? And I was, you know, worked in a restaurant and an Argentinian steakhouse, like, you know, had all the different jobs that you do when you're doing the struggling artist kind of thing, right? and I had like really wonderful flatmates when I lived there that become like your family. But I think England was just like too big for me, right? And there was things about, and it's weird because it's a little island, but London, I should say, London was too big for me. It's like such a big city. Mm-hmm. And there's things about Canada that you miss. Like I missed having space between houses, you know, like, 'cause they're all joined together.
Yeah.
I missed, like having a car to go grocery shopping. It makes me sound really superficial. It's like, whatever. But I missed the mall as opposed to individual stores. I missed sunshine.
A small one.
No, I miss the mountains, you know, and I did love being in London in a lot of ways, but I was homesick. You know, some people move to another country and they're like, this feels better than where I was before. Mm-hmm. I'm going to stay here. But I think the whole time that I was in England, there was a part of me that was just like, I do miss. And so I was looking for a reason to go back home and just didn't know the reason would be that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But also going, okay, I just couldn't quite imagine my dad just being alone right mm-hmm. after this. Right. You know, and I think I remember he was like, how does the washing machine work? And I was like, oh, okay, all right, let's get going. Right.
Yeah.
They were very much of that tradition of like the divided roles. Like they each worked very hard, but in different areas and didn't have a lot of crossover. Right.
Yeah.
but like, we were like the odd couple. You know, that old movie, The Odd Couple, like that was, and like, I actually consider myself, I mean, obviously I don't want any of this to have happened. But if you don't have a choice about it happening, I feel oddly lucky that I got to have this period of time with my dad where we were roommates. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Cause like I wasn't a kid, I wasn't a teenager anymore. I was an adult. I mean, yeah, I was like still like not like rolling in the dough or anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But like we kind of shifted gears from being totally father-daughter to being like roommates. And, you know, the couple of, you know, there's every once in a while, we kind of go back into that dad-daughter where it'd be like, you were out late last night. And I'm like, no, I'm 30. You're not allowed to like do that. But like most of the time it was like, we'd go to cooking classes together and we'd take the wrong cooking classes. Like we should have taken the, like, how to cook chicken, but instead it was like how to make pasta from scratch. And it was yeah. like a fancy thing where I was like, what are we doing? We do not have a pasta making machine at home. But like, yeah, we did all these things together and, you know, would watch Star Trek, The Next Generation together at home and like all that. And I don't think there's a lot of people that can say that they've had this time in their life where their parent is well, and you got to just like be roomies. And I know a lot of people be like, that is my nightmare. But like when the circumstances are what they are, you find the joy in it. Right. Yeah. Like,
yeah.
And like, say I felt like I could leave when I knew that he had a new journey to take. Right. Mm-hmm. And in terms of my journey, you know, it's that thing that you always think about, right? But like, if I hadn't moved back home, I wouldn't have met my husband. So I wouldn't have had the kid that I have. Like, yeah, I'd probably have another creation of a kid somewhere else kind of thing, right? But like, I think about that growing up where like when I finished junior high, all the kids went to one high school and I went to a different one because it had a better drama program in it kind of thing. And that changes your trajectory. Like there's all these tiny things that change your trajectory too, right? So this kind of is what it is.
Yeah. Did you and your dad, how did you interact in your grief together during that time when you guys were living together? Do you feel like you grieved together?
Well, I mean, he is British.
Right. That's what I was wondering. How much feelings do we talk about?
I mean, initially lots for sure. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. But then there's something that's quite beautiful that happens that I've noticed when people get older, and I'm generalizing hugely here, but particularly with men who I've seen are very stoic and have that barrier when they're younger, is it starts to go away when they're older. And then, so now my dad who's older, it's like his heart is on his sleeve, right? And like, you can see the emotion in his eye. Like I went to visit him for Christmas, and he gave a toast and, you know, talked briefly about my mom, which he can do quite openly around his wife, Sheila, as well, which I think is really lovely as well. But like, he'll tear up every time. And like, I got to go over and give him a hug and stuff. And I think that my memories of my childhood with my dad is like, I don't remember ever seeing him cry. Mm. And I see him very open now to be okay with sharing. I don't know if he's okay with those feelings coming out or whether he just has less control of them now. I'm not sure, but like there's something that I actually like about it because it makes me feel closer to him.
Yeah.
But we would never have conversations like, tell me how you're feeling. How are you like this? How are you processing your grief? You'd be like, go away. What are you talking about? Right.
Yeah. Something wrong with you.
Yeah. So that's never been a part of it, but you know, just memory, going down memory lane with him, and then like him just being caught up in a moment where some, you know, like I remember once he came to visit me like a couple summers ago, and I drove up, he was at a campground because he was there with his motorhome, and I drove up and he just kind of welled up with tears because he went, oh my God, you looked like your mom so much in that moment. Because I'm getting closer and closer to, like, I'm only about a little over 10 years away from when she passed away. So I'm starting to look more like her, his last memory of her. Right. Yeah. So he'll kind of get like moments of like, oh, you look like her. Right.
Sure. So, oh man. Yeah. That's a whole other.
Yeah.
Oh, do you ever see that in the mirror too?
No, but I don't think you ever can in yours. Like, you know,
I look at it yourself and see it.
Well, even with my own kid, like, cause my husband has red hair and blue eyes and she has red hair and blue eyes. So it's always like, she looks like her dad, but then people be like, no, she's got stuff from your face going. And I'm like, really? Oh, well, that's nice. But it's harder to see it on yourself. Right. So,
and you met your husband when you were living with your dad?
Yes, actually. I think he slept over and was like, why are we at your dad's house?
Right? So that's an episode of a sitcom, I think, actually.
Right? Yeah. And then it's that thing. So you're in your 30s living with your dad. I'm like, okay, there's reasons. There's reasons.
Backstory.
Yeah.
Oh, man. If you can kind of look back on the last 16 years, what are the real, do you think that there are real significant and obvious ways that this has shaped sort of the person that you are now? I mean, of course it has. I just wonder what they are, I guess.
I think it's made me, even though I'm kind of contradicting myself a bit because I was saying sometimes it feels really like you're asking a lot of people to talk about grief or memories of someone who's no longer here, kind of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't feel that way at all with my daughter. So like, we're really open. And, you know, I think some people are like, well, your kid from the age of 5 on, when she started asking, and she knows that my mom drowned. Right. And she, mm-hmm. you know, like a lot of people will be like, why would you say that? And I'm like, I don't know. She's interested. She wants to know about it. I mean, like it can be off-putting sometimes, like be walking in Safeway and she'll suddenly be like, I'm sorry, your mom drowned. Like, you're just like, oh, what? Oh, thank you.
Kind of thing, right? Mac and cheese.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And it is back to back with those other comments. So it's made me not afraid to talk about complex issues or emotionally charged issues mm-hmm. with my kid. And and I'm not afraid to explore those themes in my work. And I think my experience has made me approachable when other people are going through stuff. Like, I think,
yes,
I don't get weirded out, right? Yeah. Because I've been there. So, you know, I've had some people say, oh, it's just really easy to start talking to you about something that's difficult, whatever it might be, kind of thing. Yeah. And I like that. I like mm-hmm. that people feel that they can feel safe and unjudged yeah. for them, you know, when they're talking about these things, and that I don't feel like they're taking up too much time or mm-hmm. whatever. Right. So, yeah. so, but that's a nice thing that's come out of it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so. And I think it, like you said, it's different even for you and I to have this conversation, and it goes back to your little like community of grievers thing. Like when yeah. you know that somebody is experienced some sort of loss or tragedy, you just know, well, they get it. And the conversation yeah. immediately takes a different, goes to a different level, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you, by any chance, I meant to ask you this before we started recording, have a copy of the poem that you wrote about your mom handy on your desktop? I wonder if you could read it.
Yeah, I pulled up the email I sent you. So yeah.
Great. Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. So I wrote this a few days before the funeral. And then after they'd done the eulogy and stuff, I stood up and I read this. How can this be? How can the wind still blow through my hair? How can the sun rise in the morning? How can the river still bring peace? You were. How can this be? You should have left us while you were sleeping. Laughter is forbidden now. Joy is cast aside. Only rain and solitude may stay. Summer must be exiled. Birds must fly away. For nothing, nothing has meaning now when one so loved could be ripped from my grasp. But you had the strength of the oceans. You were as bright as the moon. So how can we cast away this world, knowing it is you that lives in birdsong, knowing it is you that blows through my hair? It is this I must hold on to, because you would. It is this I must believe in, because you would. It is this I must accept, because you would. And I'm trying, Mummy. But all I can feel, all I can see, all I can hear are these words. How can this be?
Thank you for reading that.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. I think the part that really got me, and now that I know when you wrote it, I think it's really even more amazing. This very strong and sustaining notion in the part where you say, knowing that it is you who lives in birdsong, knowing it is you that blows through my hair. It's a pretty powerful thing to be able to feel and believe so soon after you lose somebody.
Yeah. And it's, it's weird because I kind of consider myself an atheist too. So, and I think part of that is because my mom died, where I'm like, well, that's bullshit. Excuse my French, right? No. But like, I've never been a big believer of organized religion, even though like when my mom grew up with it, it was really about community. And, I think she really missed that when she came to Canada, and she initially tried to go to churches and stuff when we were young, but it was these big organizations that felt impersonal and all this stuff. So she eventually stopped going. And then I was kind of in the land of agnostic. I do love the idea of, the scientific kind of like your energy never dies and it goes to other things. And I think that that's more that feeling I have is I like the idea of that she's still in nature, do you know? And I think that's kind of where my spirituality lives and where it's kind of landed because of this experience as well. And you know, like I do find solace going down to rivers and things like that, even though that's weird, I suppose, because that's where it all ended. But I also know that she really liked to be in those places too. And I do. So,
Yeah. Well, this has been lovely. And I really appreciate your time and your storytelling and your voice.
Yeah. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about Elizabeth Howells Reese Elson. A lovely, lovely woman. Yeah.
Oh, well, I've loved getting to know her a little bit.
Yeah. Do you want something in it? Little champagne or orange juice?
Something in it. I'm going to think of that a lot now. Yeah. I love it. Oh, you'll have to do that with Ruby when she's older. Yes, definitely. In the accent, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Awesome, Nikki. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.
Okay. You too.
All right.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you to Nikki for sharing her story here today and for letting us get to know her mom a bit. One common element from every person I talk to who has lost someone is that they want their person to be remembered, talked about, to still exist. And so I thought I would end today's episode by remembering Elizabeth a bit more in reading something Nikki sent me about her mom before we recorded this conversation. Before I do, one more reminder of how you can support this podcast. Sorry I'm Sad is truly a labor of love for me, from finding guests and researching topics to preparing for interviews and recording and editing all the audio myself. A great deal of time, energy, and thought go into each ad-free episode. So if you value this podcast and want to show it, you can go to www.patreon.com/KelseySnow, that's KelseySnow, to become a member. For those who hear these little messages in each episode but aren't familiar, Patreon is a platform that allows people to directly support the people creating work they value for as little as the cost of one cup of coffee each month. Your contribution will help keep this work going, help keep it ad-free, help it grow, and give you access to the Sorry I'm Sad Patreon community. And as always, if you can't support the show financially, you can show your support by leaving a rating and review, by listening, and by sharing it with your friends and family. And now, back to Liz. Thanks, as always, for listening. Remembering Liz, a life of love. Elizabeth was the cherished wife of David and beloved mother of Tim and Nikki. Without a doubt, Liz was one of the most generous and kind people anyone could know. She touched the lives of countless people, and her absence is devastating to so many. Liz would have been 58 years old on August the 24th, 2005. Words cannot express the sorrow we all feel and the impossibility of filling such a hole in our lives. We are here today to grieve her loss and to remember all that she was. Family and friends have gathered their stories, thoughts, and admirations to create this tribute to Liz. Liz moved to Canada in 1974 and made a good life for herself and her family. She made many friends, but her heart was always in Wales, particularly Southwest Wales. She loved the countryside, the people, the traditions, and the culture. She brought this strong sense of identity with her and was one of the most Welsh Canadians you could ever meet. The first thing that comes to most people's minds when they think of Liz was her ability to love and nurture everyone in her life. Her career was as a nurse and as a mother. She nursed the very young in hospitals and the very old in retirement homes. She nursed her children when they were feeling down. She nursed her husband. She nursed her friends. She nursed strangers. She nursed animals in need of care. She nursed. She nurtured. She loved.
As parents, Liz and friends shared their hopes and fears about their children. She would proudly but modestly describe her children's achievements in their chosen careers. Liz also had a deep connection with her own parents. Her father went into the church later in life. He had a common touch and people skills that made him beloved throughout his parishes. It was through him that Liz developed her love for all things antique. Father and daughter were always picking up bizarre knickknacks from auctions. Sadly, he passed away on the brink of retirement before he could see his grandchildren. Liz's mother was a very private person, content to support her family in the background. When she was younger, Liz was a shy lady, but over the years, she matured into an outgoing woman with a love of people in a way that was so like her father. Liz never strove for fame or glory. For her, the important things in life were to support family and friends who were so dear to her and to help them be the best they could be. In doing so, she achieved much more than any public glory could provide. She had a strong connection to family and community. She never lost the closeness she developed with her extended family in Wales, and at the same time developed an extraordinary bond with an amazing group of friends here in Calgary. The theater group, the golfing ladies, the bowling ladies, the lunch groups, the Welsh Society, the Rotary Club, the Engineering Society, the list goes on. And Liz was certainly the hostess with the mostest. She clearly loved people, never happier than when she and Dave were entertaining a house full of friends, making each and every one feel special and welcome. She would always spot the person standing by themselves at a gathering and would have a natural ability to include them. She seemed to have a knack of knowing when someone needed cheering up, and you'd find she'd sent you a little gift or invitation to lift your spirits. She encouraged others in times of sickness or bad golf days, was cheerful, and always fun. Bubbling over with fun, many are the times she, her family and friends would giggle about the most ridiculous things. She could always be counted on for a funny story or an upbeat perspective. And so we must do the same for her. So let's remember her love for the gin and tonic, her love for spicing up the evening. Every time her children came to visit, she would be in a festive mood and would try to sneak champagne into their breakfast orange juice. She would look at them innocently and say, "Don't you want a little something in it?" Let's remember the time a spark landed in her hair, sitting around a campfire. She jumped around and found it funnier than anybody else. On a similar theme, let's remember the time her menu caught fire at a restaurant from a candle on a table, and how she was momentarily puzzled because she could no longer find what she wanted to order. Let's remember her sense of adventure with David, which was one of the reasons they loved each other so. Liz and Dave would constantly be gallivanting off to who knows where in their motorhome with their scooter, yes, you heard that right, scooter hitched on the back. They kept each other forever young. Sometimes it was hiking with friends in Kananaskis, telling these friends they were welcome to use the honeymoon suite in the RV. Sometimes it was visiting lakes or campgrounds, but most of the time it was visiting vineyards in the Okanagan. In their younger years, they would find themselves washing the dogs with tomato juice as a result from another encounter with a skunk, or riding donkeys down the Grand Canyon. But their most recent adventure would be getting caught in a buffalo stampede in, yes, you guessed it, their motorhome. Better than the scooter, I suppose. Let's remember the artsy Liz, the Liz with style. She always looked her best and had a special touch with a scarf or choice of color that was uniquely hers. She loved to paint and would make arts and crafts for Christmas and other holidays. She was in her element as a home decorator and was always in the process of completing a project, painting designs on cupboards and doors with varying success. But her real obsession lay in the garden. She was addicted to garden gnomes and driftwood. Everywhere you looked, you would find a funny little man in a hat sitting on a log. And then there's her love for baking, or trying the baking of others. One friend she crowned the meringue queen, while she was better known as the champion baker of Welsh cakes. But these baking ladies would venture outside to become golfing ladies. What started as two close friends taking golf lessons together blossomed into a group of 10 inseparable friends who ended up chatting more than putting. Golf, for her, was an opportunity to share the joys of companionship and laughter with people she loved. Bowling, on the other hand, was a different story. She showed her competitive side one day when she earned the highest score by getting a printout of her totals so she could rib Dave about it for days. This fun-loving woman kept her optimism even when she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2002. With the help of the Tom Baker Cancer Clinic, she battled the disease with a determination, grit, and stoicism that was an example to us all, and she became a cancer survivor. Her courage allowed all who loved her to face up to her disease and to support her in her battle. Her absolute refusal to be defeated by her medical problems was an inspiration to close friends going through similar battles with their health. If Liz could keep smiling through it all, then so could they. Yes, Liz will be remembered, Liz will be loved, and Liz will be horribly missed. Her adventurous spirit and enormous capacity to love will help us through this time. It is an irony of life that the river she so loved would ultimately claim her life in such a tragic and untimely manner. As you mourn Liz today, as you remember her. Know that she would be moved to see all of you coming together as a community to offer each other support and love. And she will rest in peace, knowing that this community of people will continue to support and love each other for years to come. The past is now.